everyone is a star child, made of stardust and the infinite potential of the universe. This extraordinary, fearless something in each of us clamors for freedom from the bonds of fear, conformity, and an ordinary life. Welcome to Dr. Durr's Living in the Sweet Spot, where practical tools and solutions from the intersection of mind-body medicine, science, and spiritual well-being awaken and empower you to live out your infinite potential, to live life in the sweet spot. Welcome, everyone. I am your host, Dr. Balan A. Durr, and I want to thank you for joining us today as we are going to have an amazing conversation today with John W. Fountain. And he is an award-winning journalist, and he's also many things, frankly, but in addition to all of those wonderful things that he has managed to do, which we will discuss, he is also a member of what I call one of the menfolk in my village. So we're going to talk about today his trip to Ghana, his writings, his many accomplishments, again, as an award-winning journalist, his book on fatherhood, and many more things, but about how writing is important in telling our stories and mentoring and the fulfillment of our lives. Again, we have these conversations about what I describe as mental wealth, which is brain health and transformative thinking, and how that is the gateway to the demonstration of our greatest infinite potential. So with that said, let's start this conversation with John, and then I'm also going to tell you a lot more about his accomplishments. So John.
Yes, how are you?
Hi there. you know, I am so excited to sit down and have this conversation with you, because this, of course, is kind of, I'll say culmination, but obviously an ongoing conversation that you and I have been having since we met in May of 2012. And you know what? So here's the thing about that. I had to go and grab the book and cheat, right? Because I had to go, this John's book, Dear Dad. And I said, when was that we met? So of course I had to go open it, and you signed it for me. It says May 25th, 2012.
Wow.
Yeah.
A long time ago.
Yes, it was. And of course, you were so gracious. And at the time, I had recently published my own book, Heaven Abounds in You. And you were so kind and so gracious. And then we signed copies of our books and then gave them to each other. And you actually were there at the Starbucks and having a conversation with some of the other menfolk in your village, right? And I came upon you all. And because at that time, of course, because I was so wanting to learn and understand about menfolk, and I tell people, you know what? I love people in general. And especially, but in particular, when it comes to menfolk, I love Black men, right? Because mm-hmm. you all are so, you for all that you all have endured, and by and large, I think you've managed to hold on to your identity and your humanity, and you still stand strong and say, we are still here, right? So, you know, you all are kind enough to kind of let me kind of move into the conversation and have it with you. But before we continue into that part, what I really want to do though, is I want to go ahead and I wanted to do it, you know, with us engaging. I want to share just with folks how fabulous you are. Yeah. Right. I want them to know that, because I know, you know, you're humble and so, you know, and quiet and soft-spoken, although you and I both know that, you know, when folks come the wrong way on your Facebook page, they're going to get checked. They are going to get reeled in.
As we should.
Yes. So, but you have really done some amazing things, but more importantly, amazing things in service to our people, and I think to the consciousness of this country, right? To awaken them and to hold them accountable to their promise, right? To what they've said in the Constitution. And so hold them accountable to that, to that promise, to that commitment, as you know, as some people say, you know, that bounce check. And it's one of the reasons that I love you, how you combine your brilliance and your soft-spoken and your humor and your poetic writing. Oh my God, at times it just brings me to tears. It's just so moving. And but still combine that with the strength that still that says, you know, I am all of a man. I am all of a human being. And what matters most for me is my humanity. So those those are things that I just that I love about you. And how I describe that about you is that you are a beautiful masterpiece in the soul of a man.
Hallelujah.
Let the church say amen. Yeah.
Been quite described like that, but I'll take it.
Well, you know, because well, you know that that poet in me, right?
Yeah.
That's and that's where that comes from. But yeah, I think that that is more than an apt description. So let me just go ahead, like I said, and share some of these accolades. So, you know, again, you are John W. Fountain, a native son of Chicago's West Side. And that you are an award-winning columnist, journalist, professor, publisher, and author of True Vine, a young Black man's journey of faith, hope, and clarity, and then Dear Dad, Reflections on Fatherhood. You're also a full tenured professor of journalism at Roosevelt University, and that's been since 2007. And you have written a weekly Sunday column for the Sun-Times, Chicago Sun-Times for 13 years. And as a journalist, you chronicled the stories of murders for 30 years, mostly in Chicago. In 2021, you won a Fulbright scholar, excuse me, you won a Fulbright scholarship to Ghana, where you taught at the University of Ghana at
Yes, Lagone.
Lagoon and conducted a research project, Africa Calling: Portraits of Black Americans Drawn to the Motherland. And so obviously you've won numerous journalism awards over your nearly 40 years of your career. You've authored five books, including the latest one, which is Soul Cries in Black and White and Shades of Gray. And obviously you've been a freaking guest commentator on radio and TV. And I just want to mention in particular, of course, you've written for some of the big ones, like the New York Times, the Washington Post. And then also, you know, your book, Dear Dads, ended up becoming a series on National Public Radio. So, you know, in that life, you know, you often share your inspirational story of going from poverty and the urban mean streets of Chicago's West Side to the top of your profession. Then you're also the founder of West Side Press Publishing in Chicago, and more recently, Fountain Works NFP, which is a not-for-profit focused on telling the untold stories of marginalized and unrepresented people in print, digital, and other forms. So I know that I know that that's like a whole bunch of mouthfuls, but I really want folks to understand just how much really of a legend that you are, right? That talking about standing on the shoulders of the ancestors. Come on. So thank you again for joining me on camera to
Nothing.
continue having the conversations that we've been having, you know, over the years. So my brother, the masterpiece and the soul, the masterpiece and the soul of a man. How you doing today?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
I'm awesome. Like I said, I'm excited. I'm so excited to have this conversation with you. So, you know, how about if we start, because I think, again, just to kind of where we began was that conversation where, again, you were gathered with some of the other men folk in the village. And we began, you know, you were sharing some of your stories with me about manhood and what that means to be here in Chicago, and particularly in light of the fact that, as you describe it, that you grew up fatherless, you know, on the West Side.
Yes. Well, it is, first of all, thanks for having me. It is a pleasure to speak with you in this format, and all the things you said, I'm really grateful and humbled by them. You know, I grew up fatherless in this sense that my father, my natural father, left us when I was about 4 years old. And I have two distinct memories of my natural father. One is he's being led out of our apartment in handcuffs on the West Side of Chicago. I later found out because my mother thought that he was going to hit her. Mm-hmm. And so it was an issue of domestic abuse. And the second distinct memory I have of my father is I am 18, standing over his casket in Evergreen, Alabama. He had been killed in an automobile accident. He was drunk and driving, coming out of his mother's driveway when a semi-trailer was coming over a hill and struck him. And he was hurled through his front windshield, his head hit the pavement, and he was killed. Mm-hmm. And I grew up with two distinct memories of my father, or two distinct things about him. I knew that he was light-skinned. You know, my tone is dark. And I love all of it. And my sister, coincidentally, same father, same mother, she is lighter than you.
And, really?
Yes, my father's complexion. So I knew he was light-skinned. Those are the memories that I held on to growing up, and that he chewed cinnamon gum. And I say I held on to those memories because he didn't come to any of my assemblies. He didn't come to any of my graduations. He didn't come to any of my basketball games or my track or cross-country meets and all of the various things that you experience and encounter growing up. My father was never there. You know, my greatest wish was one day I would look up in the stands at the basketball game and I would see him. Or, you know, I say in my NPR essay, the God who embraced me, mm-hmm. I used to dream that my father would drive down the street and I would see a car at least, and the car would pull over and the guy getting out would be my dad, but it never happened.
Yeah.
And so that emptiness, you know, was something that I carried for such a long time. And I still say that even today, as a full grown man with a good sense of healing from from fatherlessness, I still feel that hole. I just, mm-hmm. you know, the pain lessens, but I say the most traumatic thing that happened to me in childhood was being rejected by the man who should have loved me first. Mm-hmm. And I think that there are so many men for whom that is a reality, so many young ladies for whom that is a reality. And so, you know, I think that, you know, someone said that that which doesn't kill you makes you stronger, but I'm going to go a step further, that when we survive trauma and drama, then I think it is incumbent upon us to go back and save somebody else, mm-hmm. to help someone else. So I've long been a mentor. I've long, you know, first been a father to my own children. But understanding that, you know, in our community, the issues that affect us are of such magnitude that we cannot afford to just save our children alone. We must be community fathers. And again, charity begins at home. You can't be out saving the world when you're not spending time with your own kid. You can't be a FaceTime father. You can't be a drive-by father. You got to be, you know, involved in this. And I think sometimes when men say that, you know, there are some fathers or some men who get offended. Look, I'm not casting stones. None of us are perfect. But the truth is we have to be present. You know, the greatest gift, and I will shut up after this, that we give our children is not our presence, our P-R-E-S-E-N-T-S,
yes.
But it's our presence,
yes.
Being in the midst of them, and not just what we say or what we show them, but how by how we live, what I call the de facto fathering that falls off of us when we sort of walk by the way and our children and other young men and young women are looking at us when we're not even aware that they're doing. We're showing them what it means to be a man, what it means to be a father. And so I endeavor to do that.
Well, I think you raise a couple points, and one that the way I said is this is, of course, we're all the essence of who we are is energy or spirit, and therefore we are always connected to that which is everything and to the creator of everything. And the difficulty, of course, the thing comes in is that we forget that who we are before we came into the physical body is who we remain, and we lose sight of that in the coming of the physical body and having that huge reduction of that allness and wonderfulness that we are into a physical body. Mm-hmm. And then we in losing sight of that identity, then of course, as you say, you know, our earthly father is, you know, for many of us, our first hero, right?
Yes.
For us girls, he's our first love. And so then, of course, that's who we derive our sense of our identity, more importantly, our sense of value and worth, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to your point, when that's missing, children, what we tend to do is to say, what's wrong with me that my father doesn't want to have a relationship with me?
Yes.
And instead of recognizing that as a child, there's nothing wrong with me, but what it is my earthly father does not know how to father. Right. And, you know, I certainly understand, you know, the sense of pain and rejection. And because it's similar to my experience, and you know, and I've kind of shared this before, which is, you know, my dad was like 20 when I was born. But more importantly, when I started to dig into the history of things, especially as an adult who's trying to understand
mm-hmm.
what was going on with me and my experiences, you know, my dad doesn't even know his father's name.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, my stepmother says that he does or did, but my dad will say he doesn't know who he is. So you take that level of, you know, woundedness and trauma and the lack of love and acceptance and the lack of, you know, modeling of what a man and frankly, a father is, should or could be. And then he's got to figure that out for himself, mm-hmm. right? Only doing what he knows how to do. You know, what I say to folks is, you know, a hammer is a hammer, you know, because what we learn as children is what's around us is what we copy, or we choose to say, I'm not doing that. Mm-hmm. But so a hammer is a hammer. If you grow up in a family of carpenters, you use a hammer to build. But if you grow up in a family of burglars, you use a hammer to break and enter.
Yes.
And so the same thing is true fatherhood and manhood, you usually copy what you see, or frankly, what you don't see. Because that's the other thing too, people don't realize is the importance of that absence has as much of an impact as presence, right?
Yes.
Because we're interpreting what your absence means as it relates to me and my value and my worth. And so, ooh boy, it's been, it's been quite a journey because, of course, that model of man was who I picked in terms of partnering with. And I remember a few years ago, I was leaving my dad's house because he, again, I tell you, he was around, but again, he wasn't very interactive, right? We would go visit on weekends, but he just really wasn't engaged. And I think, again, when you throw in what his experiences were, and then those experiences of an African American man in America, that's and one of the things that I'm going to do at a later time is, talking again to some of my other men folk in the village, when they talk about the level of stress and pressure and threat that they come under, that at times they don't even want to talk about it. So, maybe that's what accounted for, his distant his distance and not being so engaged. But I remember leaving one day and we hugged each other goodbye. And so I said to him, I said, I know you love me. And he seemed a little surprised. And he said, how can you tell? I said, 'cause I can feel it, right? I can feel it in the way that in the energy in which you hug me. So while the relationship is in terms of the level of engagement has been far less than I wanted, and I'm just being honest, I've had to work through, my resentment and my anger and my feelings of rejection and all of that at the core, in working through that and not being the little girl, I've had to say to myself, and he loves you, right? But again, he can only use his tools in the toolkit the way he knows how to use them, right? And I try to offer that to not only for myself, but any other people that I have this conversation with as a way to help them heal. And then the other thing I tell people is the other thing too that's important to recognize is actually rejection can be protection. And what I mean by that is we have these ideal of who a parent should be, who a father should be. But again, if you're using hammers to break and enter, you actually better off from them not being present, right? And if they were the ideal father that we imagined to be, hoped for, desired, deserved, then they would be there and they would be there doing the things that we wanted them to do. But because they're not, there's something else. Then under the pressure of feeling like I can't handle all of this, this is too much for me, it's overwhelming, I should be able to, but I can't, then you're actually better off that person's being absent in your life, even as a child, because then you don't have the trauma and the wounds of someone's presence that was actually harmful to you.
And that is so true. And I find that that is a grown-up lesson. As a child, you can't process that. And I think that children often romanticize, even if after they've grown up, romanticize about the parent who was not there. And the reality is, for me, when I got good and grown, and I went to see my father's mother, I call her my father's mother. Someone had to point that out to me. I consciously called her my father's mother rather than calling her my grandmother. And it wasn't it it was that was who she was. She was not my grandmother. I had a grandmother who was present in my life, and who loved me and took care of me and all of that. But I had a conversation and went back to Evergreen, Alabama. I say, I need to talk to her and resolve some of this for myself. Mm-hmm. I say in my book, Truvine, as my grandmother, Authorine Jackson, began to talk about who my father was and to talk about his drinking and the drinking of relatives and, you know, began to unfold for me this story of trauma, of people who, you know, were amputees and had all kinds of illness because of lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
I literally thank God that my father was not in my life. I said, because I know how this turned out, and that's no shade against my dad.
No, of course not.
But thank you, Jesus.
Right. Thank you, Jesus.
And thank you, Mama.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And thank you, Grandpa and Uncle Gene and my stepdad, Eddie Clancy, for pouring into me and showing me how to be and do better. And so that was important. And you know, I also think it's one thing for a kid if the case is that your father can't be a better man.
Mm-hmm.
It's another when you know that he won't be a better man. He has decided to not be in your life. I mean, and I say this and I chuckle, but I have nothing that my dad ever gave me except his DNA and his name. His name was John Fountain. And so that gave me.
I just want to add this little piece, yeah, though. I also think that this too is part of the maturing process.
Yes.
Is when you can say, thank you for that. And thank you for being the vessel that I came through here. Yes. And it's not easy. And I'm not saying it's easy, because, and I liken it to this, if you want $10,000 and you know that your family can't give you $10,000, but they give you $100 or they give you $500, say thank you for that and then go get the rest.
Yes.
Right? You know, because people can only give you what's in them. Like I said, you know, I have a bottle of hand sanitizer sitting on my dress, on my desk. Mm-hmm. And when you hit the pump, what's coming out of it is what's in it.
Mm-hmm.
Hand sanitizer, you know, that gonna be lotion. It's not gonna be water or juice. You know, it's not gonna be anything other than the hand sanitizer. So, if we can mature ourselves emotionally and mentally and do the healing, then we put ourselves in a space to be grateful for what they gave us, even though it wasn't all of what we wanted. But as you know, an adult who's grown and matured and healed the wounds, you know, and especially for, you know, folks like you and I who know who the Father really is and the Creator, that know that He loves us more than anybody else, right? And He said that to me. You know that no one loves you more than me. But of course, it's obviously believing and accepting that. But then be grateful because of what the vessel here has agreed to do. Yes. Right. You know, there have been times I told somebody I had taken a year off because I was traumatized, depressed, burnt out. You know, I had saved enough money to do so. And then I also forgot about my health insurance, which was over $800 a month.
Mm.
So, right. And so I was like, okay, God, listen here. And this is what I told you, I said this to God, listen here. And I did it this way in order to eliminate my doubt. I said, you know, I give my talents, my time freely to whomever, wherever I am. I said, so I expect you to handle this. I don't expect to be paying my mortgage late. I don't expect it to be missing. I don't expect any of this. I expect you to handle it. And in making that demand on the abundance that God is and trusting Him to take care of me, guess what happened the next day?
Hmm.
My ex-husband calls me and says, hey, I know this has been a tough time for you. You're kind of struggling. Here's $5,000. Pay me back when you can. And here's the other part too. The other part was, I said to God, I'm not picking the vessel. I'm not saying who it should be. It should be my family. It should be whomever. No, you work that out with the vessel, whoever it's going to be. You work it out.
Send it on down.
And then, right. I don't care about the vessel. That's just between you and the vessel. Right? So, and in no way do I want to minimize what you're saying, because it is crucially important. Yeah. It has a great deal to do with the absence of our earthly fathers in our lives in a way that nurtures us and loves us and appreciates us and accepts us and values us and empowers us, right? Yes. It's hugely important. And there's so many of us that that have missed out on that. But again, you know, something else you said was charity begins at home, but that's because they've not learned how to love and value and nurture themselves. So again, so how do you do that? It's like, you know, again, when they say pull yourself up by your bootstraps, but how do you do that when you don't have any?
That's right. Right?
So they have to begin with self, so that they can then give it to us. But I know that for you was hugely important, is that in his absence, and how you wanted to be a father, and the fact that you actually became a father at 17. And I remember actually reading that. I was like, oh my God. Woo-wee. So you want to share some of that about,
you know, becoming a father at 17, it was the summer
on the West Side.
Now, don't go picking on the West Side. It's the best.
No. I am not picking up on the West. I'm not picking up on the West Side, because I'm just talking about how challenging it is.
Very challenging.
Yeah.
Challenging. I was living in K-Town, mm-hmm. a student at Providence St. Mel's School. It was the summer of my year between my senior year in high school and going off to the University of Illinois in Champaign. I became a father, and, you know, it's funny how God works. That summer, I was working for a place called SPUN, Society for the Protection of the Unborn Through Nutrition. And I was a counselor. So my girlfriend, I got counselor. And it was a scary thing. You know, I didn't know about being a father. You know, I knew this. And I said this as a child. My children would never have to look for me. Mm. They would never have to wonder what I look like. And I said, I don't know all that fatherhood entails, but I tell you what, I'm going to do everything I can to be a father to my children.
Yeah.
I have 5 adult children. I was there for each one of their births. And that is true. They've never had to wonder who I am and where I am. I've been an active presence in their life. And I don't pat myself on the back, but, you know, the other day I was talking to my eldest son, who is 44. The one who was my firstborn at 17, he called me up and he said, Dad, I called you to tell you that I'm proud of you. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He said, I know you say that to me, the fathers say that to their children, but I want to say that as your son to my father, that I'm proud of you. And I said, you know, son, I never got to say that to my dad. He said, I know. So, you know, so many of us have dealt with this brokenness, but I think the pathway to being better is healing, and the pathway to healing is forgiveness and accepting our fathers as being imperfect creatures, but also what you said, and understanding who and whose we are, and that God doesn't make mistakes, and we have an opportunity to change our lives. And sometimes, you know, we do that like building a house, you know, one brick at a time, and laying the foundation, and, you know, making decisions, making good decisions that over time equal a good life. And it's hard work. It's hard to be a father. It is, you know, one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life, but it's also the most rewarding. The mm-hmm. last thing I want to say about that is I used to think as a child that I missed out tremendously. And I know in some ways I did, mm-hmm. in so many ways, with my father not being there. But as a father, I now realize that the person who misses out most mm-hmm. when he's absent from his child's life, it is the father.
Yes.
What a joy to see your child take their first step. What a joy to see the light turn on and to see them, you know, accomplish things and to, you know, have their dreams come true. And to have grandchildren. And it's amazing. And so, you know, as the other part of forgiving my father was, I really feel sad for what he missed. And there is an opportunity for so many fathers, even if they've fallen off, to try.
You know, and of course, you know, as you were talking, I also think about the fact, you know, how you get to see your baby girl emerge into the world, right? Imani, yes.
Yes.
And so the gift and the blessing that that is. And I think the other thing too, to your point is, you know, we have this fantasy of about our parents. And again, we all deserve the best parent. I'm never, you know, never going to say we deserve less than that. But again, I think if you look to what I call truth or reality, you know, I think one, on the child side of the equation, you know, if we could realize this, or if the parent would just acknowledge this, I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I did not know what I was doing. And you got hurt in the process.
Yes.
So I
I'm just, sorry.
Yes, I'm sorry. But I did not know what I was doing. And then it would make sense. You know, I tell people, as much training and education as I have as a child and adolescent psychiatrist, right, who's been in practice for over 20 years, I don't parent perfectly. And I have far more tools, again, training and education experience than parents ever get, right?
Yes.
I have to have a license to practice. I had to go to medical school. You know, that's a minimum 4 years plus, you know, residency was 5 years plus being in practice. I have to do things to have a license and to sustain my license. Parents don't have to do that. I tell people, you know, what's the truth of how you become a parent? The only requirement to become a parent is having sex. And you ain't even got to do that well. But the requirements to have the baby are entirely different.
Yes.
So, and a lot of people never learn or acquire those tools. So many respects, we're asking people to be able to do what they don't know how to do, what they never learned how to do, right? I tell them, it would be like, would you come see me for surgery as a psychiatrist? People are like, no, why not? Because you're a psychiatrist, right? I said, if you let me operate on you, you wouldn't be surprised if you came up with a limp, would you?
No, not at all.
So I think it's really important, again, to try to grow ourselves up in terms of mature ourselves emotionally and look at what the truth is.
Yes.
To accept those truths, to say, you know, again, the fruit is consistent with the seed. If you plant apple seeds, you're going to get apples. If you plant weeds, you're going to get weeds. And so if you have somebody who has sex but doesn't know how to parent,
yes,
how they parent is consistent with the seed. The fruit is consistent with the seed.
That's right.
You know, so, you know, and also another way I try to offer people looking at it is, and this is the really tough one, I'm just acknowledging it, which is, in their absence, they teach us some of the most important lessons, which is, of course, is not depending upon, is that no person can be our everything. No person can be all that we want, all that we need, all that we deserve, even as a parent. And that, again, is two people who are spiritual people, that not to make people our God, right?
That
our creator is the creator, but other people don't make the vessel, don't make the vessel our God, right?
That's right.
So again, I, so applaud you and have such great and high regard for you and in that and in your efforts and in your efforts of fatherhood. I think also, again, as you talk about, though, that part of that for you then leads into, and I think was a part of your journalism, right? And telling your stories and telling the stories of our people and telling the stories of social justice, like the young man that you did the series on that came up missing in one of the sundown towns. So why don't we talk about that in terms of, your how you became a journalist and your desire to tell your stories and our stories and
Well, part of wanting to become a journalist was my passion for writing, and it really dates back to goes back to K-Town, to the west side of Chicago. I saw poverty growing up, and more than the broken glass and everything else. And I wanted to make a difference, and I didn't know exactly how to do that, but I've always loved writing, and I believe in the power of the pen and in the power of writing to shine a light on the dark corners or hidden corners of society. And so I wanted to do that as a writer. I went to the University of Illinois in Champaign as a freshman, and I wrote an essay, really inspired by Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man, in which he talks about this notion of the invisibility of Black men. And I said, even back then, I don't feel invisible, because if I were invisible, when I walked into a room, no one would react to me. And when I do walk into a room where people don't look like me, there is a reaction. And I said, I feel like a shadow. Shadows can be scary. Shadows, are shadows make a teddy bear grizzly, and so on. And I wrote this piece, and so my freshman writing instructor at Illinois, she copied my essay for all of the freshman writing classes to analyze. And some of my friends came back to me and said, "Hey, John, is this your essay?" I was like, "Yeah." I was like, "Man, that's pretty cool." And so I was really excited. It took me back to writing stories when I was in seventh and eighth grade, and people were really pleased with what I wrote, my classmates. And I met with my rhetoric instructor, and she said, "What are you going to do? What are you majoring in?" I said, "Well, I'm planning to go to law school and become a criminal attorney." And she said, "You should think about becoming a journalist." And I was like, "Okay." So, life happens when we make other plans. And so I dropped out of school, ended up going back some years later, and it was very clear to me that the thing that I was most passionate about was writing. And my first job out of journalism school was at the Chicago Tribune. And I'd done a number of internships, about six in total, at newspapers across the country. And I was covering, I was a nightside general assignment reporter. So I was listening to the police scanner late at night, and I would hear calls of shots fired and man with a gun, man shot, and so on. And it became very clear to me that most of those calls were coming from the west and south sides of Chicago. And I would also often listen for the block to see if it was close to home. And I came to understand that as a Black man in journalism, there before the grace of God go I, just another dead Black male gunshot wound victim. And we didn't cover most of those stories. So I began writing stories about those victims, writing stories about my community, writing stories about social uplift, writing stories ultimately, like last year about Jelani Day, who was found in floating in the Illinois River down in Peru, Illinois, and stories about the 51, mostly African American women who have been murdered in the city of Chicago, one organization believes, by at least one serial killer. And just writing stories to try and make a difference. I think that that is what I've been called to do as a writer, and with this particular gift, and evolving steadily, not only in my writing, but also multimedia storytelling and video documentaries and some other things I want to do.
So when you, as you say that, one of the things that definitely takes, and it takes me back to, which is one of the things I remember the most from our first conversation was the fact that, of course, your biggest fear was not being meaningful, that you were would be marginalized and dismissed in such a way that you wouldn't be meaningful. And
Invisibility.
right, invisibility. And I think, you know, one of the things that, of course, that makes me think about too, then, of course, is the return home. So, you know, I certainly wanted to, we've talked about it a little bit, but not really in depth about, you know, so what is it, what is a Fulbright scholarship and, you know, winning that and then, you know, living in Ghana and that experience. So, yeah, I really want to hear about that.
A Fulbright scholarship is essentially a scholarship to the world. It's funded by the United States government, and people have heard of the Marshall scholarship and also of the Rhodes scholarship. The Fulbright is the granddaddy. It is you can go to any place in the world. You pick the city and the university that you want to go to. I picked Ghana because I had visited Ghana about 17 years earlier, and I wanted to return because Ghana was the first place that I've gone that I've ever felt free, not like a black man, but as a man. And me and my dark skin, my melanin full, I could stand out in the streets of Ghana, and I saw all my people, and it was a beautiful thing. And so
So, you
while
know, I just want to interject this one more thing, because, you know, of course, again, you know, in terms of my liking my coffee, and I tell people, I like my coffee light, but I like my men dark.
Lord Jesus.
Yes, you know. I just want to affirm. I want to affirm that. You know. Again, I love people in general.
Yes.
But yeah. So,
Well,
but I just.
don't you go to Ghana, because there's a whole lot of dark-skinned black men.
So I get what you're saying too about being there and just being a man, because of course you're now a part of. When I say the majority, I don't just mean the majority in that country. People of color were the majority on the globe, right? So now you're in an environment that represents that. So I'm sorry for interrupting, but I just
No,
had to say that.
it's
Yeah, you know, because we got this whole colorism thing going
okay.
on,
Yes,
in our community, let alone in the country. But so I just want to affirm, you know, the beauty and the richness of dark skin. So.
Well, Ghana has all of that, and it was the people of Ghana are beautiful people. They are kind, they are respectful. They remind me of how we used to be growing up on the West Side, that you did not disrespect your elders. That I was standing out one evening with a gentleman who took care of the house where I lived, and we were standing on the street, and there was a young man approaching. He was probably about 15 years old. And when he got to us, he said, "Good evening, gentlemen." I was like, "What?" And it was just, my name is John, but over there my name was Mr. John or Prof. And it was just they hold professors and educators in high esteem, high regard. And one of the difficulties for me in coming back home to America, and this is a story for another day, the side note is that in Ghana, I became more tribal than I've ever been. I am now extremely tribal, and I say I am undeniably African, but
So now, what does that mean when you say tribal? What does that mean for you?
it means that I'm undeniably African, and I'm unapologetically American, and I am the embodiment of the compound word African American in all of its full weight. I am the grandson of Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth and Mary McLeod Bethune, and I'm the grandson of Frederick Douglass and all of those great black folk and the nameless black folk who perished, dreaming and hoping and praying on southern plantations, hoping that another generation of them would finally be free. And they could say to me in Ghana, and I suspect they always will, that I am not Ghanaian, and I've not done the lineage, and that's okay. I do know that I am more than likely from West Africa, and I from West Africa. And I did see my aunties and my uncles and my cousins, all my kinfolk in Ghana. Different name, but that was them. I saw them, so I know where I'm from. But they will tell you Ghanaians are very proud people, and they're very tribal in terms of the tribes that they're from. They understand where they're from, and they will tell you, you are not Ghanaian. You cannot tell me that I'm not American. My ancestors' blood, sweat, and tears built this country, and I am always American. And so while I will eventually, I plan to go back to Ghana to do some other things, to do a cultural exchange, because I think we must understand each other, and that what is needed to heal us across the Black diaspora really requires that we go back to Africa in one way, to understand what happened to us, and to understand that we control our own destiny. But I'm always an American. But not just an American, I'm an African American.
Yes.
Thank you, Ghana.
And you know what? I want to acknowledge what you said about your sense of freedom, because, you know, there's a picture of you standing by water. I can't remember if it was, I think it was the ocean.
Yes.
I don't think it was the river. And you're standing in like a white linen shirt.
Yes.
And some loose kind of flowing pants. And oh my God, yeah, you just look so free.
I was free, free indeed.
Yes. Huh?
I was free indeed. And, you know, yes. And it's funny because I think there is among our people a sense, a search for freedom, because America keeps moving the goalpost. Mm-hmm. And as you said earlier, you know, this check that has been marked insufficient funds, and America still has not delivered. And, you know, I realize while in Africa that there is not perhaps a country that will fully embrace us as the lost tribe, African Americans who came here through the Middle Passage. But there is a place for us. And it goes back to, again, that sense of fatherlessness. I am not fatherless. Correct. And I never was.
Correct.
My earthly father may have not been there.
Yes.
But I know who my daddy is. Father, yes. Abba. And we have to rest in that and stand upon that.
So, you know, I absolutely in agreement with you. And that's definitely has been a part of my journey. It's also the coming into the trust of what the Creator has said to me about, you know, I am you and you are me, you are mine, I am yours, right? Heaven abounds in you. Yeah. You know, I am here with you. You've never been alone. I've always been with you, right? And I have helped you before. I will help you again. And I think one of the things too that's important again is in terms of understanding identity, but then also in terms of understanding the tribalism that's still pervasive in you know, across the world. Because if I see you as you're part of my tribe, one of me and mine, but somebody else isn't, then what do I have to do to you in order to protect me and mine? And so I, you know, the way I characterize it is this, think about this. If you play in football, you don't let the opposing team march down the field unopposed, scoring at will. You do what you can to prevent them from scoring, and then you try to score as many points as you can. So if you think of it like that, in the sense of that, you know, being a different race or ethnicity in this country is them seeing us as, you know, as a competing team, as a competitor, as a threat, as the enemy. So then it shouldn't be surprising that this society has done to us what they've done to us in terms of basically bringing us over here as a commodity and then continuing to try to keep us in that place of being a commodity, right? Not being, you're not human. And that's how you also justify your inhumane behavior towards someone else, is by denying their humanity.
Yes.
So I think, it's important for us to recognize the game, right? So that you're in a better position to play and win the game.
Sure.
So your intent in going to Ghana, because obviously it's also the Fulbright is also it's a teaching and research
Yes.
scholarship.
Yes.
So what were you looking to research while you were there?
Well, I was teaching at the University of Ghana, teaching journalism, and I had a wonderful group of students. I swear to you that African students, they absorb the world and they are just interested in any and everything. And it also requires that you, as a professor, be at the top of your game because they're going to ask questions and so on. But so I did that. My research project was the work in progress, which is Africa Calling: Portraits of Black Americans Drawn to the Motherland. So it was a qualitative research study, which I interviewed dozens of African Americans who now live in Ghana. And one of the things that a number of them said to me on as I was about to return was, "Tell the truth when you go back. Tell what it's really like. So
Yes.
you don't have to worry." Well, we'll do that.
You definitely don't have to worry about you being a truth teller. And the thing too, as you talked about that, actually my first time on the continent was just last summer, and I went to Morocco. And what was so interesting was this had kind of been building over time in terms of my interest in Morocco. And after I booked the trip, I'm driving and Spirit says, "You're going home." And I said, "Really? Really?" Right. And I'm like, "No, maybe I just made that up because I wanted to hear that." Right. And then again, it came to me again, "You're going home." And I'm like, "You know what? That's really, really interesting." And I love to travel because for me it frees my mind, right? I can't operate on automatic. There's different people and the different cultures and the food and the cities and the architecture, all that stuff is different. And the people there were just so wonderful. I was like, "What is this?" And so I asked somebody, they were just so in service is what I would like to say. And I was like, "What is this?" And then someone told me, they said, "Well, because they were on the trade routes of old, right? So you have all these people and cultures and things coming through there to trade. And for them, culturally, it's dishonorable to be unkind or disrespectful to visitors to your country." And I was like, "Oh, okay, that makes sense." And I was actually even able to went to a doctor's appointment actually down at Rush, valet in the car, and the gentleman I came to pick it up again, he was just so nice and so serving. I was like, "Where are you from?" He said, "Morocco." And it even turns out we had actually been on the same flight, the exact same flight going over there. And he was saying, "I went to Casablanca, he went to Rabat." And he was saying, had I known, he said, I would have invited you to come to my home." And I know he was very sincere because when I was there, I met somebody and she was there for her brother's wedding. And she's like, "I really want you to come and be my guest at my brother's wedding." But that's like a 3-day event, right? So I was like, "I'm on a tour and I can't, I would love to." But I'm just saying, it's that kind of, that kind of welcoming and that kind of openness and that kind of heart and giving. I absolutely, there is that within us that always calls us home, right? And that I strongly encourage us to pursue, because guess what? This may be where we're born, but I like to remind people emerged on the African continent 2 million years ago. So everyone is a descendant of Africa, right? Everybody, everybody. So you know what? We just got a little bit left. So can you go ahead and tell me about the new book you've got, and then also I guess, is it a new publishing company that you started?
I actually started a nonprofit organization which is going to focus on journalistic storytelling in print and digital. And we are going to do documentaries and also have a mentoring arm, partly through the reading program that I started for school children in Matteson, Illinois. And we're also going to move forward with a multimedia journalism literacy program that I'm going to take back to Ghana. While I was in Ghana, I had the opportunity to train about 60 journalists from the Ghana Broadcasting Corporation and talking about the fundamentals of journalism, but the importance of truth telling in a democracy. So we're going to continue to do that. So if anybody wants to find me, I'm Googleable at author at johnwfountain.com or author at johnwfountain.com, and you can find me there.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that question of where they can find you, because there's a lot to sort through. So when you said the multimedia journalism, what is that? Give us a brief description of what that is exactly.
It is no longer just a new wave. I mean, because that is where journalism is right now. It's called convergence journalism, which fuses print stories. So we'll do long form narrative storytelling, but we'll also embed videos, storytelling videos within that that print story that is posted online on a digital platform. But we'll also do photo sound slides or podcasts and other kinds of interesting picture, video, storytelling. So it's a mashup, but it is it's interactive, designed to give people the stories in the way they like to consume them. As much as I tell my students they need to read books, and they need to be reading the New York Times and other publications, sometimes their eyes glaze over, and I know what that means. And sometimes I have the misfortune of asking them, so where do you consume your news? And some say TikTok, and others say Twitter. And I try to fashion that. I say,
Oh, Lord Jesus.
you get the link on Twitter or TikTok to the New York Times. Yeah, I just try to advance it. But so I know that we're consuming information in so many ways, and I just want to be able to deliver that information, that those stories that
Okay,
help.
and your latest book, where can they find that?
Well, I'm working on my latest book. My latest book is the Ghana book. I love Ghana and Ghana Almost Loved Me. That'll be out in the fall, as well as a book, 50 Cent a Word, Diary of a Freed Black Journalist, is a memoir of being a journalist in mainstream America.
All right. So and are you publishing those or?
I am,
Okay.
yes. So if they
Okay.
just go to johnwfountain.com, they'll get all the information that they need.
Yeah, johnwfountain.com. So, John, of course it is always just such a gift and such a delight and such a blessing. And I want to thank you personally, also for the guidance that you have offered to me, as it relates to my son Jaron, who's a 17-year-old. Because I tell him, I said, sometimes I'm talking, when I see John, I'm just like, John, Lord Jesus, y'all, you alls, these Y chromosome people, y'all, Y chromosome people, which for the folks that don't know this, men have an X and a Y chromosome, women have two X's. So I call men Y chromosome people. And basically, I'm just like, it just, I didn't grow up with boys or men, so I was like, if I had grown up with brothers, I said, you know what? I wouldn't have wanted a man.
Yeah, you
Whatever to deal with my son. So I thank you again for being one of the men in my village in order in helping me with him, and my own growth and development. And I so appreciate you having this conversation. As we know, we're gonna call this pushing the pause button, because it will continue on, right?
Yes.
And I just want to again remind people that I'm Dr. Durr, and awakening, empowering you, and also from the about your infinite potential, your ability to live out your infinite potential, to live life in the sweet spot. Thank you for joining us today in the sweet spot. Share, follow, and like us on social media. To learn more, please visit BalinADurMD.com, spelled BalinADurMD.com. Join us next week, and remember, when you heal your mind, all things are possible.